The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Well, good afternoon. The clock on the podium says that it's time for me to speak. And so that's what I'm going to do. Let me make sure that my apparatus is on. Well, welcome. This is early football and the American way. And as I looked at one of the pages here, it's got this interesting look. This page, see, you can all see that so well. It's got a little design on there which indicates that this talk is part of Scholar Sandbox. And I can't tell you how proud I am to be part of Scholar's Sandbox. I didn't know that I was part of Scholar's Sandbox until I got here today, but I'm delighted. Well, it's fitting that I begin a lesson on American football in Dallas, Texas. See, I come from the Palouse near Pullman, Washington. My alma mater is Washington State University. It used to be the State College of Washington. And I've got the program for when we went to the Rose Bowl, the only time we won a major Rose Bowl, but there we go. Dallas, Texas is home to Southern Methodist University. And the SMU Mustangs were one of the biggest things going in the United States in the middle of the 1980s, right here in Dallas. SMU came of age in the college football scene in a new era of college football. This was an era when television revenues were growing exponentially at staggering rates. This is the time when Super Bowl advertisements started to reach eye-popping numbers in terms of the cost to stage an ad on the Super Bowl. Many major universities began enjoying the benefits of national exposure. Prior to that time, national exposure was pretty much reserved for USC and Notre Dame. This was due in part to a 1984 Supreme Court decision by the U.S. Supreme Court handed down, which gave cable networks the ability to negotiate television rights with individual conferences and with individual institutions, rather than with needing to go through the NCAA. And so what this has meant since the 1980s is that TV contracts have driven colleges to move conferences regardless of the impact it might have on traditional rivalries, regardless of the impact on the logistics of regional travel. Soaring television revenue is going to force local festivals like the Pasadena Tournament of Roses that I had up here earlier to chuck generations-old regional traditions and create a national bowl championship series. And, Deb, I can see that handout pertains to my talk for tomorrow afternoon. That doesn't... All right. So disregard the man behind the curtain as I threw water on myself here too. And yet, all right. So the 1980s were also the decade of cable television becoming prominent in our national life. They rose from obscurity to challenge the three major networks. The beginning of the 1980s, nobody had ever heard of music television, MTV. Certainly no one had heard of an obscure station in Bristol, Connecticut called the Entertainment and Sports Programming Network, or ESPN. But we all know what came of that. This is the time then when the SMU Mustangs came of age. In the changing landscape of big-time college football in the early 1980s, the Mustangs emerged as one of the tallest peaks on the horizon. Big football meant big money. Dallas boosters had money, and they wanted their team to win, and they were willing to pay for it. So they collaborated with coaches, with university officials, and they paid players and fudged academic standards. And the result was an NCAA investigation. Sanction was not met with compliance, and ultimately FMU was handed down with what has been described as the death penalty. In 1986, the NCAA basically declared for the following season SMU was ineligible to field a team. That is the death penalty. It took over 20 years for SMU to recover its program and reach a stature where they could have a winning season. So here we see them pilloried. This is from Sports Illustrated, 1987. Shame on you, SMU. The fusion of academics and big-time athletics is something that we see in our national life today, and it's a combustible combination. And I want to clarify, I'm not talking about the fusion of athletics and education, but rather of big-time athletics and education. There's an important clarification to make here. One of the most destructive impulses in many medieval versions of classical education, I would actually say, would be the association of learning with sedentary behavior. I'm not concerned about combining athletics with education. In fact, that's something that ought to be restored. But big-time athletics is a different animal. Different animal. Big-time college athletics you watch on TV is a different animal. This is not education, it's commodified spectation. It's not an individual's bodily exertion on the playing field, but rather it's a spectator's purchase of an entertainment product. Most people involved in big-time college athletics, like me, participate as marketplace consumers. Their participation requires no strenuous exertion whatsoever. We buy tickets, we buy the sweatshirts, we pay Time Warner or Comcast for the privilege of watching these events on television, and some of us run up bar tabs as we gather with our comrades. This is the participation in athletics that I'm talking about. This is not the vision for athletics and education here in the fiction, in the big-time context, that oxymoron we call the student-athlete. As spectators, we all work to perpetuate the myth of the student-athlete. And when you face a scandal in major athletics, you undermine the reputation of the university's academic program as well. That certainly happened in 1987 or the mid-80s with SMU. One of the ways of illustrating that, and I could illustrate it time and time again, but David Letterman, who just finally left the air, but went on the air with one of his famous top 10 lists. Top 10 courses for athletes at SMU. Number 10, subtraction, addition's tricky pal. Number 9, the first 30 pages of A Tale of Two Cities, foundation of the classic. Number 8, sandwich making, final project required. Number 7, alumni-owned hotels, restaurants, and car dealerships, the interlocking economy. Number 6, I'm censoring that because this is David Letterman after all. Number 5, the Denny's menu, recent discoveries. Number 4, the Bunny and the Wolf hand shadow workshop. These are courses for athletes at SMU. Draw Winky. Number 2 is also censored, but number 1, the poetry of Hank Stram. The point here is that this top 10 list, like so many things that you could see in the media at the time, is an attack on the academic integrity of SMU. The academic integrity of an institution that's supposed to be dedicated to learning. Now, culture warriors in the 1980s looked at the level of corruption that entered into SMU and its athletic program and its academic program, seeing it as evidence of decline in our culture since the good old days of football. Well, I'm here actually not to talk about the 1980s. I'm here to talk about the good old days, early football, and there's a number of points about it that I want to make. Let me present to you as an entry into this the good old days, a Chicago Tribune article from 1905. The pull-away quote says this: "Receipts from the big football games have been so large and have increased so much in the last 8 years that unless something is done to check the evil athletics may soon become more important than the colleges themselves in the public eye. We view with alarm the tremendous amount of money received from football and deplore the magnitude which the receipts give to athletics." This was over 100 years ago. The story of college athletics is not a story of golden age, a height from which we have descended. But this is the genesis story of big-time football. And that's what I want to enter into. McClure's magazine, also 1905. This is the same muckraking magazine that published that long expose of Rockefeller Oil, or Standard Oil, John D. Rockefeller, did this long investigative report serialized over several issues on the college athletes, reporting on payouts to students, admission standards that had been fudged to sign on good football players, awarding passing grades to athletes who did not even attend class, dubious scholarships for work study programs for which the so-called work was to go to football practice. The McClure's expose featured Eastern schools, but the Midwest was covered by Colliers, ran a similar expose at the same time, and also covered the East Coast as well. But it featured University of Chicago and Northwestern. But this Colliers also published the income received by the Harvard Athletic Department for those years. In 1905, for example, the income for Harvard's athletic department was $72,500, most due to football. That is over expenses of just $15,000 that year. Football pays. No wonder that last year the University of Oregon in Eugene took in $196 million. $130,000 last year. That's $196 million, University of Oregon Athletic Department, and University of Texas, $161 million. Now, I said Oregon's income, $196 million. The expenses were $110 million. Why do colleges get into athletics? Because it just makes perfect sense. It pays. And it always has. It always has since its inception. The Colliers expose here, quoting a university president who said, "The greatest evil in colleges today," today meaning 1905, "is the prostitution of academic ideals in the pursuit of athletic prestige." 1905, the prostitution of academic ideals and the pursuit of athletic prestige, the greatest evil in colleges today. Well, why am I here? Oh, there's the Harvard balance sheet. I don't know if you can make out those numbers, but that's the 72,000 I was describing. And if you can make this out, football's income is 72,000. Baseball is a distant second at 16,000. Football was king. And always has been on college campuses. So why am I talking about this, and what do I want to probe about it? This is a talk about football, but I want to demonstrate a number of points by means of talking about football. Some of these are historical points. Some of them are historiographical points. Historiography is just a word with additional syllables to make scholars sound important. This is the scholar sound box after all. But first, the story of American football challenges our pet narratives of cultural decline, I want to question some of our narratives of cultural decline that Americans, and especially classical Christian educators, tend to cast over our history. It's interesting following Dr. Moeller after saying this. But I want you to recognize that when any pundit wants to criticize something in his own era, one of the common strategies is to enshrine an early era, construct it as a golden age, and then use it as a whipping tool to bludgeon the present contemporary times. The Israelites did this. Things got a little rough in the kingdom. They began re-remembering their earlier period of bondage in Egypt as a golden age. They even called Egypt a land flowing with milk and honey as a way of assessing the problems of their time. Of course, that was their own unfaithfulness. Roman historian Dapian and Sallust brilliantly deployed this strategy by setting up the Roman Republic as a golden age in order to make the Roman Empire of their own times look really, really bad. We Christians need to speak a prophetic voice in today's society, but we need to do it properly and well. We should at least pause and reflect before rushing off to manufacture golden ages in the past, especially golden ages about America's past. Scripture is the measure that we're supposed to live up to, not some constructed, concocted good old days. So SMU in the 1980s was indeed grievously corrupt. It deserves criticism. I'm not saying that we shouldn't criticize. I'm not saying that things never do decline. What I'm saying here is that when Christians do engage in cultural criticism, we should be careful to engage the issues in the right way and for the right reasons and not be stupid. All right, so be careful about our pet narratives of cultural decline. Secondly, early football offers a powerful account of the United States at the dawn of what some historians have called the American century. In 1900, it was the British that dominated the world of finance, trade, and culture. The great cricket-playing peoples of today are one of the lasting testaments of Britain's greatness. Cricket is wonderful in Australia and India and south of Africa and Jamaica. That's where the British Empire used to be. Well, if you look at 100 years later in the year 2000, this is a different era. It's no longer Britain, but it's the United States that holds economic, cultural, and military hegemony. This is, then, when I go back to the turn of the 20th century, this is an America coming of age on the world stage. We had just finally settled the West. We began to assert ourselves again as a world power. For the first time, we began to see ourselves no longer as latter-day Europeans, as derivatives from the old world, but we began to see ourselves as a distinct people who stand on our own cultural footing. We saw ourselves as possessing a culture that's unique to us, distinct from Europe. Early football displays this American exceptionalism as well as anything else does. Third, as we in the United States came into our own over time, the story of football points to our culture as one formed around bureaucratic control and litigiousness. I call this here the pattern of American reform, the pattern of Pharisees and libertines, and I'll explore this in more detail when we get into it. We Americans fancy ourselves to be a society ruled not by men, but by laws. Oh, we love law, don't we, here in the United States? But the law we love is the letter of the law rather than understanding virtues. The story of football, then, is in part a transformation away from, as we will see, English schoolboy rules of rugby that filled about two pages in the 1870s, but by 1912, the year the NCAA finally took the name NCAA, the rules for American football had reached 112 pages. That is made in America, from two pages of rules to 112 pages of rules. Finally, the story of early football challenges the notion that historical significance is reserved for wars and politics. This is something that my students know that I love to talk about. The undercurrent of this whole talk is evident here. History is not just about wars and politics. Human beings express themselves in all kinds of behaviors that are not necessarily political in nature. the bonds of society, some of the tightest and most important and most precious bonds that tie people together are not political bonds in nature, but bonds of other types. And it's a colossal failure of our historical imagination when we reduce history and the things that we inquire into in history as the stuff of politics, of the generals, and of the lawmakers. So more on these themes later, but look for them as we move into the details. Let's go now to early football, and I want to tell you the story here of how football is going to emerge. Among the handful of American sports that have grown up to attain big-time stature, American football really does have a unique genesis. The origins of baseball and basketball, by contrast, are creation stories that begin where the game actually takes a pretty clear shape and structure that fundamentally remains fairly unchanged. Go back into the mists of time and you can't find any other dimension than 90 feet for the distance between home and first base on a baseball diamond. Basketball was invented in 1892 by James Naismith to get boys playing sports in the wintertime indoors. And the rules just came from his imagination. By contrast, football's story is that of a game morphing through radical changes, lurching from one new development to another new development, one after the other, without any guiding direction toward what it's going to become. American football is a sport that went through about 50 years of just trying to figure itself out. Meanwhile, it reigned. Football had developed then, as depicted in this image, initially as a game that we would recognize as similar to soccer, developed on various college campuses. This is from Harvard in 1857. The first intercollegiate game, which is a game between teams representing two colleges, was 1869, Princeton and Rutgers. And if you've been to New Jersey, you know that they're practically neighbors of one another. But the prominent team from Princeton collided with the prominent team in Rutgers, and it would have looked something like this this year. But as the game grew in popularity just a few years later, in 1873, representatives from three colleges got together, and these were students who were the representative. They got together from Columbia, Rutgers, Princeton, and Yale. That's four colleges. I say three. Columbia, Rutgers, Princeton, and Yale. And they met in New York in order to harmonize the game, because the game had developed idiosyncrasies on the various campuses, and they thought, well, if we're going to match up one against the other, we need to sort of standardize our rules. And so they standardized rules in 1873. And a version of the game that employed many of the rules that we would think of as soccer, and the name is from that year is going to persist today. That's why we call it football, because it was largely a kicking game, kicking a round ball. And because these colleges agreed on rules, it came to be known as association football at the time. Now, the next year, after having formed association football, the world changed. The world changed when Harvard's team went up to Canada and played McGill. They're in Toronto. And McGill wasn't used to this game, this association football game. They, like good Canadians that they are, tied to the king, as it was at that time, they played rugby. And so what the two teams agreed to do is they would play two games, one by the rules that Harvard would teach McGill, and another game afterwards that McGill's boys would teach the Harvard guys. And so Harvard, of course, got pummeled in this unfamiliar game, but it was a game that was rugby. Some of them called it rugby football. And everyone present agreed, pretty much, at least reached a consensus, that this game that the McGill boys played was way, way cooler. It was much more fun. It was superior. Harvard players introduced the game they traveled to New Haven to play Yale, and they introduced it to Yale, and Yale agreed this is a much more fun game. So this led, a couple years later, to a more tightened association that's going to govern the rules, and they needed to change the rules, basically adopting what we think of as rugby. And there are two pages of rules that they had inherited from the old world. They agreed to play with an oblong ball. They reduced the number of players they had been playing with down to 15. That was a reduction in the number of players on each side. And they agreed again to rugby association rules. Well, there was a problem. The game was violent. Players wore no caps, no headgear. The game was divided into 45-minute halves with a running clock, and if you took out a guy on the other team, then they played shorthanded while the clock was still running. Players ran until they dropped or were too badly injured to continue. Fist fights were common. Behaviors such as jumping on a prostrate opponent went pretty much unaddressed, looked over. If an injured player left the game, as I said, the team just played shorthanded, which induces cheap shots, incentivizes cheap shots. Now, the soccer-style game had also been pretty physical. It was very rough and violent. But this new rugby version of football lent itself to a new level of violence. Some came away from the field crippled or maimed, and there were several deaths. And so the rules committee, remember the rules committee that had formed, gets together and adopts a new rule. In 1880, they adopt the scrimmage rule. This was one of two changes. Actually, the first change they made was reduce the number of players further down to 11. The number of players on a side has been 11 since 1880. Thinking that fewer men on the field will mean less roughness. But then this more sweeping change, the more radical change, was the scrimmage rule. And it marked a transformation away from what we would recognize rugby to a game that we would begin to recognize as American football. The scrum, you see, was eliminated. In rugby, the referee tosses the ball into an interlocked gaggle of players who healed the ball to their teammates. And now the team with the ball is simply going to retain possession. They're going to take turns with possession rather than having this scrum to kind of battle for possession. And that's going to eliminate some of the violence. Well, what happens next? The problem came that very year, the championship game between Yale and Princeton, which concluded in a scoreless tie. Because Yale had been heavily favored, Princeton actually thought, as they moved into a scoreless tie in the second half, Princeton thought, oh, this is going to be great. If we tie them when everyone thinks that Yale's going to whoop us, that's going to be a moral victory for us. So Princeton began playing deliberately for a scoreless tie. And what they would do, well, this is from the New York Times coverage. I'll just read from it here. Princeton adopted a new line of tactics which did not at all please the spectators. Was roundly hissed. Princeton had the ball. Actually, I'm reading here. Here's the quote. Princeton had the ball on the north foul line, and the Orangemen began a fumbling game to kill time. A Princeton player would roll the ball 6 inches over the foul line so that another could snatch it and bring it back, only to repeat the act. This was allowable, of course. But it looked a good deal like cowardice, and the crowd took it that way. No amount of hissing could make the Princeton change her safe policy. And when time was called for the last time, the same monotonous byplay was going on. What this means is that when Princeton got possession, they just moved the ball about 6 inches and restarted, moved the ball 6 inches, restarted, moved the ball 6 inches. The article captures the key point here. This was allowable, of course, but it looked a good deal like cowardice, and the crowd took it that way. No amount of hissing could make Princeton change her safe policy. So the solution to this is another rule, downs. Not only are we going to take turns with possession, but let's delimit how long we can hold possession. The introduction of downs. In the 1882 meeting of the IFA, the Yale delegation introduced this concept. And the rule that they adopted said that you had three downs to move the ball 5 yards in any direction. Well, you have to either advance the ball 5 yards or backwards 10, or else possession turns over to the other team. To keep track of yardage, they needed to line the field at 5-yard intervals, and a pressman looked at the spectacle and described it as, it looks like a gridiron. The line field, after the introduction of the downs rule in 1882, they had to line the field at 5-yard intervals, and that's where we get the term downs from. Now, at this point, I want to take stock and see what we're looking at here. But these are two rules that distinguish rugby from football. The scrimmage rule eliminates the scrum by taking turns with possession, and the down rule requires teams to move the ball when they do have possession. These two rules transformed the way that rugby had been played, and it creates a distinctively American development, American football. Conspicuously absent in the adoption of these innovations is any worry about whether the game comports with English tradition or the cultural sensibilities of the old world. To earlier generations of American college men, you see, adherence to old world norms was a marker of good breeding, high born cultural privilege, just like dressing up in top hats and having tea in the afternoon. But now, well-born Americans, and this, if you're in college, you're a well-born American at this era, well-born Americans were setting out on their own to establish cultural norms without reference to the old world. Whether they were norms of fashion or rules of a fashionable game, American norms are increasingly decoupled from English propriety. America, the United States, is coming of age here, casting off old world attachments and sensibilities. We also see the pattern here, and now it's time to explain this, the libertine Pharisee pattern. A libertine exploits the absence of rules to gain advantage, and a Pharisee answers the libertine by imposing a new rule. So notice the important narrative flow we have here. So we have foul, excessively violent play, clearly against the spirit of the game, obviously unsportsmanlike, that runs contrary to how a game ought to be played by a gentleman. That's the play of the libertine. And then it's answered by a new rule, scrimmage. Take turns. That's the classic answer to the libertine by the Pharisee, isn't it? Then the libertines strike back. Oh, now we have to take turns. We can take advantage of that. Exploit the scrimmage rule by holding possession indefinitely so that the opponent never has a chance to possess the ball. Which, of course, is answered by the Pharisee, who imposes another rule. The libertine exploits his liberty. The Pharisee counters with law. The libertine finds a way to exploit the new law. Further law is enacted. This move away from behavior governed by virtue and toward behavior governed by the proliferation of written code is a basic shift that we see moving from the late 19th into the 20th century, and it represents the American way that's going to color the United States into the 20th century. And so this amounts to then a society formed around, this is a move toward bureaucratic order. I already alluded to the fact that by 1912 we're going to have a 112-page rule book. More on some of those rules later. Business, in this era, business leaders, civic leaders were doing things that were technically legal, but were perceived by many as wrong, and anyone who had a sense of virtue would know that it's wrong. And an attempt to address it, no longer from the pulpits and from public opinion and shunning, but with new rules and codes. Wrongdoing becomes increasingly defined by codified rule rather than by common sense understanding of virtue and wisdom. All right. Now, let's see the pattern continue. One major difference between English rugby and modern American football is that in American football, and if you've watched the two games, it took me a while to see, why is rugby different? What's the difference? And the difference is, if you just see in the flow of the game, that blocking is illegal in rugby. It's called interference. So a ball carrier cannot be preceded by blockers. And that's why the flow of the game looks different. A ball carrier gets into trouble, he has to pitch lateral the ball backwards. right? So interference, the prohibition of interference had long been part of rugby. And it was illegal. Throughout the 1880s, however, this rule continued to be broken and violated through all kinds of surreptitious means. And throughout the 1980s, there were various attempts at trying to remedy it. Interference became a real source of roughness, and the violence of the game that scrimmage was supposed to address continued. And ultimately, what they decided to do is simply legalize interference. And they did in 1889. The idea was that if you just make everybody honest and block, then the game will be safer. See, because it's not going to be cheap shots. And a block is just as dangerous to the blocker as it is to the recipient of the block, right? And so there's a natural incentive in the human collision of things to limit the violence of the game if you just legalize blocking. That was the rationale. Unsurprisingly, did that curb violence? No, the game became even more violent once interference was legalized. This does not look anything like rugby anymore. Then, in 1892, Harvard took the field to begin the second half against its perennial rival, Yale. And the 10 men on the crimson side took up positions several yards behind the line of scrimmage. And they made a V formation. And before the play, all 10 men began running full tilt, all at one Yale defenseman. This famous play is later going to be regarded as the flying wedge, designed upon the popular Napoleonic principle at the time of concentrating the greatest possible force against an opponent's greatest weakness, and bone-grinding injuries ensued. Not surprisingly, players were crippled, suffered severe cranial injuries, many died. But the era of mass momentum plays had begun. You can see this setup here beginning then. You'll see those guys. I'm pointing this as if you can see me playing from the screen here. You see the fellows on the lower left there are lining up. They're about 6 yards behind scrimmage. And the guys that are spread out are defenders that are on the line of scrimmage. Before the play begins, they're going to start running at a certain spot, and then the ball carrier will go behind them. A terrible collision. Here's another setup here. So you can see the center who's going to start the play, the team lined up behind him, ready to go. They're going to start running, and then he will start the play immediately as they get there, and they've already got their momentum all set up. Well, the game became scandalously dangerous. Scandalously dangerous here. In 1894, the Rules Committee tried to put a stop to this by prohibiting offensive motion. And they required 5 men to line up on the offensive line. We've got a variation of that today. If you've ever watched football and wondered why is it the defense can run around before the play, but the offense has to line up squarely. And if a guy is in motion, it can't be forward. It's got to be lateral, right? And you've got all these false start penalties and that sort of thing. Its origins go back to this time period in the 1890s of trying to curb the violence of the game, of requiring a certain number of players to line up on the line of scrimmage if you're on offense, these illegal formations. The number has increased to 7 on the line of scrimmage. But this still didn't curb the violence of the game. It continued to be scandalously violent. So we can see these mass play collisions here. I've got several images to exhibit it with bandaged men. I love this. I found it was just serendipity. I ran across this in the New York Times. It's one of the things I do for fun is I read really old New York Times and other articles. But the tragedy of football, this is a guy... A dermatological institute. This is basically a plastic surgeon, and he advertises before and after. He fixes noses. This was so prevalent that a guy is going to advertise his service in the New York Times to straighten out a crooked nose. Tells you how prevalent it is. we see articles like this popping up again and again and again about these modern gladiatorial contests. Players may die, no more football for New York boys, and football becomes prohibited in many places. Some colleges actually prohibit it. This ran in Collier's, I think it was. You see the heap of bodies down below there, and up over the goalpost is the Grim Reaper. Men were dying playing this game. In addition to that, there were other problems that were scandalizing the game, and I'll just give you more samples of this. A team figured out that they could actually intentionally fumble the PAT, the point after touchdown. If they intentionally fumbled and then recovered their own fumble, they could be just inches away from another touchdown. That's great. Clearly against the customs, the purpose of the game, but that behavior was defended because it's legal. There's no rule against it. And so the rules committee has to adopt a rule about how PATs work. A similar problem came when teams intentionally muffed kickoffs so that they could retain possession. Again, there's no rule against it. These libertines are answered, of course, by the lawyerly rules committee, and they instituted a 10-yard minimum kickoff rule. A kickoff needs to advance 10 yards. That was also in 1894. Once interference was legalized, players on one team sewed, I love this one, they sewed suitcase handles to their uniforms on their hips. And so what they would do is they would reach and grab the suitcase handle on the hip next to them like this while their hips were being grabbed. And then they would just run down the field and mow them down. This is an early version of Red Rover or something, but the collisions were massive. Another similar one, this is from the Carlisle Indians. Some of you have heard of Pop Warner football. Pop Warner was the coach of Carlisle, but he had the uniforms altered that, the football is leather and it's got those four panels on it. Well, he would cut a football in half so it's just two panels and sew the two panels with some padding and stuffing to the jerseys of all of his players so that the opponent could not tell who had the ball. Now, a game that's based on skill and power, everyone understands those to be the virtues of the game. But these, of course, now there are rules about modification of the uniform, and strict uniform rules enter the code. They're creative. You have to hand it to them. But again, they sought advantage not through skill, not through strength, not through speed, but through tricks that changed moved away from a level playing field. Rather than bringing social pressure against these cranks for being ungentlemanly and lacking virtue, the IFA answered simply by adding more codes. All right. Well, brutality just continued here. Come back to the brutality. Criticism of the game's brutality continued to grow. And the criticisms, honestly, were legitimate. Paled in nothing comparison to when they talk about, the helmets and concussions today. These are people who are becoming maimed, losing their ability to process rational thinking for the rest of their lives. People who die on the football field. Some tabulated that deaths at high school and college levels exceeded 100 per year. In the 1890s and into the early 1900s. A Harvard tackle, Carl Brill, had played brilliantly for the Crimson throughout his college career. And he made a public statement that went like this. He says, "The season ends my football career. The Yale game is my last contest. I've been in the game 10 years, playing tackle most of the time. I believe the human body was never meant to withstand the enormous strain which football demands. Moreover, I don't believe the game is right. I dislike it on moral grounds. It's a mere gladiatorial combat. It's brutal throughout. When you're opposed to a strong man, you have got to get the better of him by violence. Many ask me what the sensations are of a great multitude wildly applauding for half an hour. I can honestly say that I have none. I stand and take my medicine, impatient to get back to the locker building and get off the dirt. Now, statements like this from ex-players are published at this time. Again, this is the time of muckraking exposés that calls for reform, and this is an era of reform. The game must be reformed. So I already have this image up here from McClure's, describes case after case of broken bodies, of a new coach. Actually, Yale hired a new coach, and the new coach recruited a bunch of guys who weren't, hadn't even gone to high school, but they were good football players, certainly couldn't pass admissions exams, and they wound up getting beat up. Then an assistant coach takes the fall, and he gets a pay raise because they won that year. There you go. And so that's covered in this, in these exposés here. Finally, then, in 1905, this is another of the exposés, but in 1905, the Rules Committee decides to modify the game yet again. These rules become effective in 6. So that's why I've got rules for 1906. They met in December of 1905 to make rules for the following season. They wanted to open up the game in order to lessen brutality and unnecessary roughness. They wanted to render foul play unprofitable, and so they needed to change the game so that foul play wouldn't get you a gain in the, and it wouldn't gain anything in terms of the score or advancing the ball. And they also placed officials in who had been bribed to look the other way, that sort of thing, under a central governing body who should supervise their work. It had been a home team that would supply the official. So how do you suppose that went? So an independent body of officiating. But the rules they adopted, as I see the list here, a definition of unnecessary roughness that's fleshed out. No tripping, tackling out of bounds, no piling up, no late hits. And then they imposed a 15-yard penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct. This is the first penalty imposed. Now, I want you to think about this. A penalty imposed, a sanction imposed for an infraction in a game. If you play a board game, if you play Monopoly, if you play Sorry or Life or something like that, when you look at the rules don't have sanctions for cheating or sanctions for bad play. The rules define what the game is. But when it becomes codified in the rules that here's what you do when someone breaks them, this is a new level. A British observer, a rugby player, reflecting upon this rule at the time, said this. He says, it's a standing insult to sportsmen to have to play under a rule, the unsportsmanlike conduct rule, which assumes that players intend to trip, hack, and push their opponents and behave like cads of the most unscrupulous kind. I say that the penalties are a disgrace to the playing field of a public school. How many times do those yellow flags come out now? They add 6 men to the line of scrimmage, limits to tackles and guards in the backfield, other offensive, the number 7, limiting to 7 on the line of scrimmage is going to come later. They also adopt a neutral zone. A neutral zone defined by the length of the ball. So it's the line of scrimmage. This shows the neutral zone here. This prohibits punching and gouging before play began, which had been a problem. If you spread the teams out by the width of the ball, at least, you've got a neutral zone. And then, most importantly, they legalized the forward pass. They legalized the forward pass, but with significant limitations that we wouldn't recognize today. You could not pass the ball across the end zone. You had to pass a minimum of 5 yards, but no more than 25. And you could only pass the ball if the quarterback had moved laterally at least 5 yards. Laterally, so there had to be lateral motion on a passing play. So what this does, I'll come back to, is that they needed, because they needed to, they had this definition of lateral 5 yards, they actually had to stripe the field in both directions at this time. So fields following the 1906 innovations were a checkerboard pattern. Here's an image of what that looked like in this era. I'm going to move on here. We've got champions of the forward pass. A lot of these limitations on the forward pass will be removed in 1912. So you don't have the limitations on how far, and you've removed the lateral motion restriction, and so that's why we've returned to the gridiron following 1912, and pass plays became much more prolific. The idea of a pass play is, for the sake of the rules committee, is that if a potential ball carrier is going to be distant from the current ball carrier, that's going to spread out the play. And passing was a safety innovation. Legalizing passing was a safety innovation. Now, the ones who adopted these rules that came into effect in 1906 was also a new body of individuals. College presidents had stepped in. They didn't trust the rules committee anymore. They formalized themselves in 1912 when they reduced the limitations on the pass into what we recognize as the NCAA and adopted that 112-page rule book. But this is the story. This is the story of modern football. And I'd like to return, if I can, to my theses. Here, I'm going to, pardon me as I flip through here, with some of the pass plays from Amos Stagg's playbook. Newt Rockne, there we go. Yes. So I want to spend a moment here to recap. The story of early American football, I think, challenges our narratives of cultural decline. It points to an era when the United States became a world power. It captures that pattern of American reform. And American reform, in many ways, still works this way. The pattern of Pharisees and libertines. Football's creation story, again, is a story of abuses on the field, foul and unsportsmanlike play, which leads to rule changes as a way of fixing problems. When players find another way to circumvent the norms of fair play, this would be followed in turn, not by moral reproach, but by the codification of another rule. So the Genesis account of American football is a chronicle of rules made, rules broken, rules amended, circumvented again, then amended again, and an endless cycle. It's the story of libertines and Pharisees. Libertines who abused the game, Pharisees who responded to their abuses with new laws. I want to point out how the libertines and the Pharisees actually, though, agree on one critical thing, and that is the meaning of a rule or a law, that its meaning is very narrow in scope. The meaning of a particular rule is narrow in scope. It doesn't speak to a virtue. It doesn't speak to a pattern of behavior, but it's tightly delimited. And so the Pharisee needs to add rules to govern behavior, and the libertine will constantly justify behavior by finding a place where there's no rule to speak against it. Both of them agree that rules are small and tiny in their scope of application. We see these problems sometimes, frustratingly, in our Christian schools, thinking that we are perhaps trying to inspire virtue with a proliferation of rules. Is that the culture of our schools? Well, certainly the culture of the gridiron, which is an academic behavior, isn't it? Well, that's the American pattern of reform, of Pharisees and libertines. Football is created as a product of this very dynamic. That's what made American football, American football. The adoption and implementation of the rules are that very thing. That's how the game morphed away from rugby. And finally, and I want to elaborate on this final point, challenges the notion that historical significance is reserved for wars and politics. I actually didn't talk about William McKinley, for example, a president during this era, or Teddy Roosevelt, for that matter, who did get involved in football and some of these reform efforts. I think that we need to question the notion that the most important people in history are always political and military people, that history's most important events are only those that have to do with making laws and waging war. It's an Enlightenment conceit, you see, that we have trouble ridding ourselves of It's this idea that the political bonds of the modern nation state are the most important social connections that people have. When history was professionalized in the age of nationalism, of course, in the 19th century, we began organizing it according to the nation state. U.S. history, French history, English history, French, Canadian history. Human beings form bonds that are more than just participation in the same ballot box. We form families. We share common spaces physically, geographically. We share bonds by eating together and singing together. If you don't think eating is significant, just ask Paul, who criticizes Peter by who he's going to sit next to. That is a social bond being spoken of here. To understand where we are today, I would submit we need to teach our students to subject the full array of human experience to historical scrutiny. When our children listen to Katy Perry, do they ever ask, where did that come from? And do they only find answers in the limited array of ballot boxes? Do we understand the whole sweep and scope of human behavior? Who are our heroes and villains? What about those who maybe planted gardens, who mothered children, who repaired carburetors, who coached Little League baseball, or maybe even who turned on ESPN and sat down next to his son, and instead of railing about how sports are stupid, asked questions about the game and asked questions about the wider culture that it represents, to look at the world as God would have us to look at the world and the culture around us. So there we have American football in the American way. We have just a few minutes left. Anyone have any questions? Yes. That was unique to American football, certainly at this time. The question was whether the comparative violence between rugby and football. And the chief reason for that is the interference rule, I would submit, and also some of the culture surrounding the game. Even today, I'm not going to deny that rugby is violent, basketball is violent, lacrosse is violent. You know, these are, we're talking about degrees, scales of violence here. And rugby, certainly, you can have life-threatening injuries in rugby, but there was no scandal attached to rugby at the time, like there was certainly at football in this time. So, yeah, good question. Other questions? All right. Well, I thank you. Oh, yes, one question in the front. Yes. That's a great question. Let me handle that in about 5 seconds. I say that just in jest. The question is, for the sake of the microphone and the recording, is all we know really is the pattern of the libertine and the Pharisee, and what's the way around that? I think the way around that is to adopt a culture, to re-enculturate our parenting. And I think it begins with our parenting and the conduct of our home. Yes, our kids need rules. Yes, our kids need standards and boundaries. But we need to teach them to love those boundaries rather than to simply obey the boundaries. Loving the boundaries is far more important than obeying the boundaries in that sense. If you disobey, you still love the boundary because of the consequence that comes and what it does, because it instills virtue. Now, the practical outworkings of that are going to be a challenge. We've got some school headmasters here who I know struggle with that. What do you adopt school rules against for dress codes and this sort of thing? And I actually think that a good, healthy, robust coaching and athletics is one of the best places to teach this sort of thing when it's done very, very well.
But you've opened a big, important topic, and that's very constructive, and I wouldn't pretend to do it justice. And with that, our time is up. Thank you very much.
I don't know anything about it.
We're
going to have some collision whenever there's physical vigor.